Comrades and friends, welcome to a very special episode of the Highlands Bunker podcast. It's brought to you exclusively by the Delaware Call. This is Rob. I'm joined by Call contributing editor Andrew Galvin. Hello.
Hello.
And our producer Carl Stomberg. Hello, Carl.
Hello.
To welcome to the studio, U.S. Representative from Delaware, Sarah McBride. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Thanks for taking the time. I do appreciate it. I do have to say one thing before we start. Our pal and Call colleague, Jordan Howell, could not make it today. So in his absence, I feel sort of compelled just to check up with you. Are you taking the train to D.C. every day?
I'm driving rather than the train. I find driving to be pretty cathartic. I know I love public transit. I love public transportation. I love the train, but I like to drive.
Jordan, turn it off now.
Speak.
He's probably just fainted.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I know.
That's okay.
I know.
We'll get you on the train one of these days.
I occasionally do it.
Yeah. So let's just dive into it.
Sure.
I think it's safe to say that many Americans have lost faith in the Democratic Party. I'm one of them, so I'll just speak for myself.
You never had faith in the Democratic Party, though.
Okay, that's fair. You got me. She got my ass already 2 minutes in. It's becoming more clear to me, and here's how. I heard Elon Musk say a few weeks ago that Americans needed to live within their means. You know, he's doing all of these mindless audits. And that's just an idiotic statement on probably 8 levels I can think of. We don't really have time to go through all of that, why that's stupid. But what it made me think of was in 1977, Jimmy Carter put a sweater on and he went on TV and he told everyone to turn down their thermostats. And what that did, actually looking back on it, was set the stage for 45 years of austerity. Reagan demonized welfare queens, but it was Clinton who codified the gutting of welfare. It was Clinton who did NAFTA. These are neoliberal ideas. The deindustrialization of this country was a liberal idea. You know, Bush started the war on terror, but Obama had weekly meetings about who to assassinate, who we could kill as collateral damage, that type of thing. You know, Obama left office as the deporter in chief. And, you know, no bankers that crashed the economy in 2008 ever went to jail. And so I think this second Trump term is a natural progression of liberal politics. Liberals set this in motion. It's moved unabated and grown unabated over Republican and Democratic governments. Is anybody in the Democratic Party sort of reckoning with this, that this trajectory was actually sort of, we were put on this trajectory by, you know, our heroes, so to speak? Does anybody think of that when they're sort of considering where we sit right now?
Well, first off, I think that, yes, people across elected office, but I think across the country are asking themselves, how did we get to this point? And I think there are disagreements about how we got here. I do think, to your point, that the last 50 years of American politics has been defined by an anti-government message that I think we have not done a good enough job of pushing back on and disproving. I think that conservative politicians have, for the last 50 years, sought to prove that government can't work by making it not work. I do think that the Democratic Party supported and engaged with policies during the course of the 80s and 90s that we are living with the consequences of today. A pursuit in the shadow of Reagan and Bush of free trade that did not adequately grapple with the consequences of NAFTA and other free trade policies on industrial communities across the country that have resulted in communities that are shells of their former selves, where there's a crisis of hope, and you see it in the addiction crisis, you see it in the economic crises in those communities, and you see it in the crisis of faith in government and in our institutions. And so I do think that there are a lot of reasons why we have landed here. I will say, on the flip side, I think it's easy to say that the Democratic Party wasn't liberal enough universally. I do think that there are instances where we have lost trust and connection with public opinion. I do think that there are instances where we've overestimated how far public opinion has moved. And I do think that there's a balancing act across different policies, across different subjects, where we have lost the organizing principle of the Democratic Party, which is to be the party of working people. And any union organizer will tell you that that often means you not only have to build a multiracial working class coalition, but you also have to have room for some disagreement in that coalition to allow it to be big enough to win elections, to advance the ball.
And yeah, I mean, that's a fundamental thing. The working class thing is fundamental.
Yes.
But I guess what I'm trying to get at is, like, okay, we have Elon Musk running around doing goofy stuff. He's a weird guy. But the idea that the tech expert, you know, the productivity guy is going to get in there and this technocrat's going to figure out how to make government more efficient, that's a liberal idea. And that's when we sort of got away from working class people and went in this direction. That's what put us on this trajectory. And that was a Democratic Party idea. And I think
it was a Democratic Party strategy and message in the 80s, 90s that was in response to Republican small government success. I don't think that it was somehow created out of thin air. I also think that we can sit here and be like, efficiency is a neoliberal concept. I mean, I think everyone wants efficiency in government. You want government to work. You want government to efficiently and effectively meet the needs of the people. And you need it if you are going to push forward the kinds of policies we believe in. If we're going to have universal health care, if we're going to have paid family and medical leave, if we're going to have universal pre-K, if we're going to have policies that require government action, people need to trust the government can competently do the job.
Yeah, and I think that's why I started the question by saying there is a loss of trust, of faith, because over time, there really wasn't a... It was actually a very... I think you described it pretty well. It was a very reactionary sort of position. It looks like the Republicans are gaining a little ground. It looks like this is catching on. Of course, Carter started it, but it's starting to work. And so Clinton was able to sort of synthesize it all. And there was no alternative to them being on this track, because the Democrats would just react to what they perceived as, you know, a Republican sort of strength, and try to take it in some way and make it liberal in some way. And there was absolutely no option other than that. And I think that is a huge sort of lessons learned for me over, I'm 50 and this happened about 50 years, so I feel like particularly placed to sort of feel it and see it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where I'm coming from on it.
Yeah, I think there is one of the problems for the Democratic Party right now is that the public does not associate us as the party of working people. And I think that one of the things, and I actually was just having this conversation with a colleague of mine, Greg Kassar, who's the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And I think he's got some really good ideas, both from a policy perspective, but also from a messaging and organizing perspective. He's a former union organizer, about how the party needs to move forward. But one of the things he was saying to me the other day, and I think he's onto something, is that when the Democratic Party moved to the center on economic issues and essentially diminished the difference between Democrats and Republicans on economic policy, and the area of contention and disagreement moved into what might be considered social policy, it has contributed now to a perception by many people across the country that we are a party that exclusively cares about abortion, LGBTQ rights, gun safety.
This is a great time to jump over to Andrew's first question, I think, or his comment about that, because when we talked about putting this together, that's something that you were always thinking about, like, where, you know, has the focus been, or has the perception been,
yes,
that there's not a focus? Do you want to sort of leap off of that one?
Yeah, so we're talking about identity to some degree, and you have been very clear that, you know, you don't center your identity in your as your political persona. Mm-hmm. And I know I've heard a lot of people actually here who aren't happy about that because they wanted you to fight harder on certain things. I've heard you talk about that. But just going forward, where does it fit in? Because after all, the Democratic Party is going to be the diverse coalition.
Yes.
I don't think there's any way around that. And so it is going to be all these people with different identities who want their identity to be central, and they want to see their particular concerns reflected. But somehow we also have to unify.
Right.
And does it take an existential threat like Trump to do that, or are we capable of doing that some other way?
Well, I think the reality is we are going to have to be a party that creates more space for people who are in different places in their journey of understanding of the full diversity of society. We are going to have to include people who haven't wrapped their mind around trans identities, for instance. You know, when you're organizing a union, you're going to have white, black, Hispanic workers. You're going to have workers who are immigrants and workers who aren't immigrants. And there's going to be a lot of different thoughts about how to grapple with that diversity among those workers who are either unionizing or are in the union. But they all agree they need better pay. They all agree they need better benefits. And I do think that we shoot ourselves in the foot, both electorally and from a substantive policy perspective, when we actively push people away who are not yet where we want them to be on a whole host of issues that are deeply personal for many of us. But we have to grapple with where people are, and we have to grapple with the reality of the world as it is if we want to build a world that is kinder and more just and fairer. I mean, I think for me, it's funny because I think if I center my identity too much, I get criticized from the left for playing identity politics. And then when I decenter my identity and say, I'm here focused on everyone and really focused on the material economic needs of my constituents, whether they're trans or not, I get criticized for not centering my identity enough. And look, the reality is I can't be the only one fighting for trans rights. I can't be the savior of the trans community. And I do believe that in this moment, when trans people are facing horrific attacks by the Trump administration and far too many state governments, that the thing that I can most constructively contribute to, tangibly contribute to, for the trans community is reinforcing that trans people are multidimensional human beings. That we are not the caricature of self-obsessed, single-issue individuals.
It also takes away the idea that some trans people are, you know, financiers, elite capitalists, have a lot of privilege, and some are working class, some are poor.
Yeah.
And you know, there's. I'm going to plug a book really quickly, Class Notes by Adolf Reed Jr. You know, for years I'd see Adolf Reed speak about this. It's a great book, and he's done union organizing in South Carolina and North Carolina. And he says, you know, when the union wins a good contract or wins a pay rise, you know, sometimes racists get it too. But everybody got the pay rise. You know, if we do Medicare for all, when we get to universal health care, bigots are going to actually get health care too. That's okay. It's actually all right. Yeah, so it's actually okay. And I think, you know, as you alluded to before, I mean, if we look at it as a class issue, if we look at it as working people not, you know, feeling resentment, not really sure why they feel this resentment, well, there's answers for that. I think the Democratic Party is slowly coming towards this, oh, actually, it's working people. It's actually people who have been sort of put down by the economy, and they're just in a bad place, and they really have no alternative. And I'm not saying that the Democrats and Republicans are the same. I'm saying, but at a very high level, where they're at in their life and their class, working class, poor, there really is no alternative. There was no alternative until Democrats started talking like this.
Yeah, I will also go a step further and own my part in that. I think one of my biggest evolutions in the last 10 years has been, I think, critique that I had very early on of sort of the Bernie Sanders movement, that it was class reductionist, and that it did not center identity enough, that it didn't center sort of civil rights and human rights struggles enough. And I think as I have grown up, as I have done this work, as I have frankly become more comfortable in my own self, as I've seen how change comes, I have moved in a place where I think we have to recognize, one, the centrality of economics to all of these issues, right? That so much of the discrimination and prejudice that we face from an institutional perspective is in pursuit of distracting and dividing people in order to pick the pockets of American workers, in order to undermine the right to organize in unions in this country, in order to privatize Social Security and Medicare, right? It is part of that politics, that political strategy of misdirection. And I also, I think more sort of practically, have seen that if we are going to build a diverse, multiracial, majoritarian coalition in support of the policies that we believe in, then we need to be less exclusionary in the language we use, in the policies that we sort of prioritize in our messaging and in our policy work, and really have a economic-focused message that does unite people, and to say, we don't have to think that you are right on every issue for us to be fighting for you, and to respect people by delivering for them across not only their identities, but their political ideology as well.
Carl, you think we can sell Sarah on the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights? It's turning into a Bernie bro. I love to hear it. that's fair enough. That's fair enough. Well, let's move on. Last year, across the country, millions of people protested the genocide in Gaza. I have to be honest with you, again, as I said in the beginning, I don't really have time or care to hear any sort of defense of Zionism or Israel. I know what it is. I know what apartheid is. I was young enough to watch Mandela go from jail as a terrorist to president of the country. And long live the Palestinian resistance. My question is, given the size and diversity of these protests, old people, students, Jews, Gentiles, men, women, everybody. When the campaign of, when Harris' campaign reached out to folks and other campaigns too and said, you know, what's your issue? And they said the Gaza genocide, it was treated like a non-response. And then, you know, some of the biggest sort of Zionist reps went out. Richie Torres went out to Michigan, where many Arabs and Muslims live, and they thought it was an insult. And the result is what it is. Again, as I said in the first question, is there any sort of reflection on this at all? I mean, I understand, and I'll be very clear, like, I know nobody wants to get APAC'd. So Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman completely understand that. But this is a serious issue. It's a genocide and it's apartheid. And if it's not dealt with, I think, again, the Democrats are going to have a pretty difficult road forward, because people like me do not have, there's no choice in the matter. And so I can just sort of check out. No choice, I'm out. So is anybody sort of grappling with that stuff?
I mean, I think that there are, one, absolutely conversations about the role that Gaza played in the last election. And I think that there is absolutely a conversation that is happening right now on how, talking about this diverse coalition, this is a coalition that does span perspectives. And there was understandable outrage at what people were seeing on their social media feed, on the news, that was happening in Gaza. And I think that we should have had a speaker at the Democratic convention that was a Palestinian American, that spoke to the passion and outrage that existed within a significant portion of our coalition and a significant portion of the country. And so I think that the party does have to do a better job of not siloing portions of our country and of our coalition from other parts, and say, you don't get the microphone, you don't get to speak, we're not going to listen to you, we're not going to take your concerns seriously. And I think similarly, and I think this goes back to this notion of respect, I think one of the problems that the party has had, that elected officials, candidates in the party have had, one of the issues we've had, is that we keep telling people you should be grateful for what you have, right? We say to folks in the base, including people who were understandably outraged by the humanitarian crisis that was occurring, well, you should be grateful we're not Republicans. We were saying to a lot of folks, well, you might be struggling under the cost of living, but you should be grateful that you're not experiencing the inflation levels in Europe. I do think we have not done a good job of seeing, validating, and listening to the very real pain that exists across our coalition, across the country, and yes, around the world.
Well, I'll just say this. I know, we're sort of neighbors. You were my state senator. You have an extremely, energized base here, fans almost. You don't need that AIPAC money. I'll go knock doors for you. Put that, think about it. Andrew, do you have another one?
Yeah, so you may recall how this whole thing began to come together was approximately 1 month ago. I emailed you on your personal email because, yes, I couldn't get through on your official, and your phones were overwhelmed because everybody wanted to know, what are the Democrats going to do to fight back and to stand up? And I actually wrote to you and said, please file articles of impeachment, even though I knew that was a long shot.
I told him not to do that, by the way. Just to let you in on the editorial discussions that happened, I said, yes, you can have her email, but I don't think you should ask her this. But anyway, in any event, a little behind the scenes.
I don't remember that exactly, but... your response was, well, I see the way to fight as in March, the continuing resolution, the budget, the debt ceiling. And then on the town hall this past week, you were speaking fairly forcefully about the idea of shutting down the government. Now, how would that happen? Do you think that's a good idea? What are the consequences going to be? Does it make sense, since you're always saying they're trying to prove government doesn't work by making it not work? So how does shutting down the government benefit anyone?
Well, look, I don't want to see a government shutdown. The Republicans have full control. They should be able to muster the votes, for instance, in the House, to have a majority to keep the government that they are running open. But they're not good at governing. And I think, you know, what the question that we have right now is, what is the price of our vote here? One, they own everything. They are the party in full control. They keep talking about a mandate. They keep talking about their strength. If that is true, then they should be able to get their shit together and keep the government open. But, you know, we're around a table. We've got negotiators around a table. Let's say we get the best possible deal. How on earth at this point can we believe that the executive branch will faithfully implement that deal, right? And they're already shutting down the government, department by department, agency by agency. They are already violating the Impoundment Act. They are already unilaterally slashing contracts and grants that are providing quite literally life-saving support for Delawareans. Why would they not just do what they're already doing, which is to implement the parts of any kind of budget deal, continuing resolution deal that they like, and dispatch with the parts that they don't like? And so, you know, we Democratic negotiators have asked for some pretty simple things, which frankly, I'm even skeptical that the administration would adhere to. Reinforcements of the already existing statutory requirements that the president faithfully implement the laws. Spend the money that Congress has duly appropriated and has been signed into law by the executive. We have asked for reinforcements of those safeguards, and Republican negotiators won't even do that. And you have to ask yourself why, if not because they plan to not faithfully execute a deal. And so, you know, they own the government. They own the levers of power. This is their problem. And they cannot conceivably expect people to save them from themselves when there is no trust that we can have in their willingness, ability, and commitment to living and abiding by a deal we strike.
But how does that play out? Like, does somebody have to blink at some point, or is it just the end of the United States government?
No. Obviously, again, I hope there's no government shutdown. But at some point, the government, I would assume, would be a continuing resolution that is passed. But the public will see that this is the Republicans' fault. And here's the thing, I think, just to sort of step back, and I touched on this in the town hall, but I think right now, and I know this is a long answer, but right now we are in a race against the clock. And the clock that is ticking is the consolidation of power in the executive branch and essentially the undermining of democracy in this country. Until that happens, public opinion still matters. Until that happens, politicians are still afraid of losing elections, rightfully so. And I do believe we have already seen that when public opinion is mobilized, when public outrage is targeted, focused, and significant, that even this administration will revisit and revise things. And certainly Republican politicians in Congress will, because there is no group of people more afraid of their own shadow than Republican members of the United States House of Representatives. And so I do believe that, and it's not just with regard to the continuing resolution, I do believe in general that public opinion turning against this administration is the most effective lever we have to rein in the worst excesses and to protect our capacity to have a democracy and therefore win the elections we need to win to implement the policies that people actually need.
Yeah, I mean, I echo sort of my agreement with Andrew on this is almost like, I like what you're saying. I actually like this tact. I like this tact, but the idea that, I mean, the Democrats haven't really proven to me that they have a lot of fighters, And you need people to go out and pin it on the Republicans.
Yeah.
There's been opportunities to do similar sort of moves over time over the last, you know, 8 to 12 years, the first Trump, and then there's been opportunities to do this. And the Democrats don't seem sort of willing to take that step and go hard. I mean, I've seen Hakeem Jeffries on Jon Stewart and Stephen A. Smith. I'm not convinced that I hope that what you say is true. I hope that people do understand that this is a drastic measure. We're actually trying to save something here. It's obviously, we can't do anything about it because of the numbers, just the sheer numbers of party, you know, who's in the party in the House. So I hope that works.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think we have to be abundantly clear, one, that when if the shutdown happens, that this is the Republicans' fault. This is their government. They have the majority. And if they want partners, they have to be partners that can be trusted. And they are not demonstrating that right now. And I agree. We have to be clear. We have to be absolutely clear. And we have to be willing to fight. And I think we rhetorically, we have to be willing to be very, 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 very clear in our messaging about not only who owns, should a shutdown occur, the responsibility for it, but we have to be crystal clear about what's happening right now. That we are witnessing the decimation of the social safety net in this country. We have to be clear that they are trying in the reconciliation bill that they're pushing forward, where there's $4 trillion in tax cuts that are disproportionately for the wealthy, almost exclusively for the wealthy, and $2 trillion in cuts disproportionately hurting the most vulnerable in our society, including the 1 in 2 Delaware kids that rely on Medicaid. We have to call out this administration and the very real consequences of their action and the very real benefits that they are giving to what are essentially at this point oligarchs in our society.
All right, last question. Over like 340 episodes of this, one of the themes has been that we're doing sort of independent media and sort of small journalistic projects, but that it's in the service of a broader political project. I have a project, and I've talked about it all through. People can go back. We don't have time for that now. Do you have a broad political project? I mean, I know you have to deal with things at hand and figure out how to work through the next month or two or the next 2 years, 4 years. But if you had a broader political project and you could articulate it, what would it be?
I think it is, to me, the one of my favorite speeches is Franklin Roosevelt's 1941 State of the Union address, where he talks about the four freedoms, including freedom from want, where he talks about how economic security is the foundation of a free people and a democratic society. And that speech, more than any other speech, is my philosophical guiding light. I believe that we fail ourselves morally and economically when we do not support people as they face the inevitable challenges of life. I believe the United States is failing itself morally and economically when we don't provide health care for every person. I believe the United States is morally and economically failing itself when we don't provide affordable child care for every family, including universal pre-K. I believe we are failing ourselves when we don't provide paid family and medical leave. I am a New Deal Democrat. I believe that government can be a force for good and the most effective and efficient means of supporting people through life in a way that allows them to not only be free, to not only be treated with respect, but to be innovative, to be entrepreneurs, to be creative, to do all of the things that only they individually can do, so long as we join together to provide them that safety net that they need. And to me, I was very excited about, for instance, Build Back Better as a next step in our social safety net's journey in this country. I would hope that the next time we have control, we pass a meaningful economic package that provides the kinds of benefits that every other industrialized nation in this world provides, like paid leave, like childcare, that we achieve universal health care in this country. And I think for me, if at the end of my life, I can look back and say, we either achieved those goals, or in some cases got much closer to achieving those goals, then I will be proud of my service and my time in public office.
Well, you're not going to see me push back on the four freedoms, are you? That's good. Get Harvey J.K. on the line. Yeah. The funny thing about that is outside the Brandywine building at the park across the street that's named for a DuPont, you know what I'm talking about? There's a statue in that park across from the Y.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what that big monument is a monument of?
No.
It's the four freedoms.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I was in there. I was just having lunch one day, and I saw, because I actually do, I have a good friend of mine, like a mentor of mine, the historian Harvey J.K., who is a Roosevelt scholar, a New Deal scholar. And so, you know, we've talked to him at the podcast about a bunch of stuff, and I just happened to see, I guess after World War II, they put it up, you know, freedom from fear, freedom from want, I forget them all, freedom of religion or worship or something. But yeah, I mean, it's you're not going to see me push back.
Wow.
On that. But
it's
right there.
Yeah,
if you go across from the Y, it's a monument to the four freedoms. And it's in the DuPont Park, which I always thought was kind of strange.
That is funny.
Wow. But yeah.
I love to hear that. I'll go visit that. I usually have all of the Delaware trivia at my disposal. That's a new one.
Yeah,
for me.
I had no idea until I just walked past it and saw what it said.
Well, and let me say, in my first floor speech, I quoted Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech, where he talked about how necessitous men are not free men, and that people who are hungry, people who are out of a job are the things that dictatorships are made of. And that, you know, what is happening here, Donald Trump is not just proving that government can't work by making it not work because he believes in small government. Donald Trump doesn't believe in small government. He doesn't give a crap about Reaganomics. Donald Trump cares about power. And the reason why these policies are the policies that this man is pursuing right now is because he knows that when people are angry, when they're hungry, when they're out of a job, it leads some, including many in our own coalition, to the well of cynicism, and they opt out of the process, and it leads others to a strong man who says, I alone can fix it. People who are angry, people who are fearful, that is how Donald Trump keeps his power. And I think we have to be crystal clear about what is motivating this man, what is behind these policies. For Elon Musk, it's to line his pockets. For Jeff Bezos, it's to line his pockets. For Donald Trump, it's about power.
Well, I appreciate you coming in. I do have one sort of last question. I know that you've sort of been, I joke sometimes when I'm doing something that is just sort of like me. It generally revolves around drinking beers or smoking weed for some reason, but I said, I've been training for this my whole life. And so I know that in a certain sense, for a very long time, you've been training to go and do this stuff. Now that you're there, did you feel ready for it, or is it completely out of control? It looks to me like a circus. Well, and I wonder what obviously that wouldn't have been your first time in D.C. or your first time meeting famous politicians or being on TV or anything like that. But just being there in that storm seems bad.
Yeah. So first off, I know the fact that what you just described about me makes me insufferable to some people.
It is what it is. I don't actually look at it that way. Yeah. I mean, somebody's got to do it.
Well, and look, I the reason why I got interested in politics, the reason why I've wanted to work in government is truly because the sources of hope that I found as a young person were in books that I read about the New Deal and about the civil rights movement. And, you know, I don't defend our institutions out of some fidelity to our institutions, but I do believe that this is the place where you can make the most amount of good for the most number of people in the most number of ways possible. And I genuinely am in awe that I have this responsibility, that I get to go into this place where, because of advocates, activists, and a handful of effective and courageous elected officials, we have made progress that once seemed so impossible as incomprehensible. I feel a deep sense of responsibility. It is a privilege. And I now understand why, when you talk to members of Congress, they go, "Why are you sure you want to come here?" Because it is a mess. And it is disheartening to see up close what I think is obvious to those of us who pay attention from afar, but it is disheartening to see up close people who, behind the scenes, yes, they are conservative. Yes, they think differently than we do on a lot of issues. But you see them be normal and kind and clear-eyed about the absurdity of what is going on, for instance, in the executive branch, and then go out publicly and just put on a complete character that is not who they are behind the scenes. That is disheartening to see. The other thing that is disheartening to see is that there are people who are in Congress just to get attention. You know, when you are in the House of Representatives, 435 people, it's hard to break through. It's hard to get attention. It's especially hard to get attention if you don't want to work very hard. And there are some people who don't want to work very hard. And so what is the strategy to get attention if you don't want to work that hard? It's to employ the tactics of reality TV, right? How do you get airtime on a Bravo TV show? You pick a fight with someone, just a single person, on something stupid. You throw wine in their face. And for some people, that's their beginning and end. The challenge of this moment is, how do you break through? How do you get your message heard while still being a serious person? And that is not always easy. And there are new challenges that we are presented with because of technology in this moment to figure that out. But it's something that I'm thinking about every single day. And it's certainly something, to the degree that I get more attention because of one aspect of who I am, I will make sure I continue to use that to center the needs of my constituents and the policy priorities that I have, that I believe speak to Delawareans of every background and every identity. All I can do right now is to try to do my best and figure it out the best that I can. And,
yeah, Bernie did it. Your newfound admiration for what Bernie was trying to do. Bernie went on the road.
You know? Yeah,
He said, "Forget this D.C. I'm going to Iowa and Nebraska, teach people about the oligarchy."
Yeah.
So that's how he's doing it.
Yeah.
Because of the exact same thing you're saying. I got to get out of there. I got to go somewhere else. I got to do my message and what I believe. And the thing about Bernie is people believe him when he says it because he's been doing it for so long.
I agree.
He's not fake. Like, he's not going out and trying to get attention the way you're talking about.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He recognizes that attention is a tool, not an end in and of itself.
And speaking of throwing a glass of wine, that's what Trump basically did today to Zelensky.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering your initial take on that. Do you think it's just another negotiating tactic or what?
Yeah. So for people who don't know, there was the big summit today with Zelensky and the White House, and it didn't go great.
No, to say the least. I think it was probably a negotiating tactic by Donald Trump, but it was a negotiating tactic in pursuit of a quote-unquote deal that ends the war on Russia's terms. You know, I think what we are witnessing right now is, and today's Oval Office meeting was sort of the culmination of it, but it's been happening throughout the second Trump administration, and it was certainly happening in a slightly lower burn in the first administration, which is we in a global struggle between democracy and authoritarianism, we are seeing Donald Trump switch the side of the United States from the side of human rights and democracy at our best, not always, but at our best, to the default of authoritarianism and despots.
Well,
on that note,
I think we could have made the same deal 2 years ago. It's a shame that we didn't. You know, I think it's very complicated, and we apply different theories to different sort of conflicts when it's in our interest. And so while it was sort of ugly to see how that interchange played out, and of course I don't think that was the right way to do it. I see no other possibility than a ceasefire on Russia's terms at this point, unfortunately. And a lot of that's our fault. But that's just the way it is. Well, we're down the Russia rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. I know you're probably running off somewhere else. You're running all around, but you ran in here for a bit. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
And, that's it for now, folks. And we'll speak to you soon. Left is best. Here's what I wanted to. The first thing I want to talk about quickly, to sort of like post game wrap up. This is a professional operation now, dude. Like, people don't want it to be, but it is. And I'm glad, like Andrew was able to join. We sort of produced it together, ran some questions off each other, see how it was going to roll. I thought that was a good part of it. But you hadn't been to the studio before. So
no.
You were just, this was your first time too. We got this thing down, Carl and I.
Yeah, I'm pretty impressed. And I thought today's conversation was very professionally managed by the MC.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I did it the same way I've done them all, sort of just by like outline and blocking them out. My questions were more. They were more thought out than just sort of like letting the conversation go, which is what I would usually do. Like if we had an hour 15, which is what we usually do, you could let some of that go a little longer, you know, and kind of, you know, play it out a little bit or make some jokes in there. I think, and you might have been copied on this, I think when we pitched it, I said something like, I'm not going to do any bits. Or I made it clear I was going to do some sort of straight news interview.
Right.
So, you know, which I think that was pretty much that.
Yeah. So, what do you think of Sarah?
I mean, bro, she's a Bernie bro now. Like 10 years too late, but a Bernie bro nonetheless. And, you know, I'm asking about if the Democratic Party sort of like has reflected on their failures. And she's a little bit vague on that, but she's certainly reflected on some of hers. I think that shows that's what that meant to me. More than just a joke about like a Bernie bro. That was the first thing that I got out of it. I mean, unfortunately, there were things that I would like to talk to. I would like to speak about for the 2 hours, you know, and we're just not going to be able to do it. So the point is to bring up the Gaza genocide and Israel the way that I did it. This is what I think. I don't want to hear any fucking bullshit. I think we could put that in the context of which we were discussing. Like, it seems like you dropped the ball here in these different places. Like, is anybody trying to figure that out? And, I mean, she said a little bit even more than I thought. I thought she would deflect actually a little more on that. But she sort of did say, like, yeah, we didn't handle that well at all. Well, what does that mean, though? Does that mean, like, yeah, people were very upset with what they were seeing. Yeah, of course, because we were doing it. So what's that mean? But, you know, you have 45 minutes. What the fuck? You're going to get an argument about AIPAC? This didn't seem productive to just keep to do anything else.
Yeah. Well, in terms of, like, people evolving in their views, one thing that I did before the election was I decided to phone bank into Pennsylvania to help Kamala try to win there. And I did speak to a fair number, you know, not a huge number, but a fair number of people who were just like, now I draw the line at genocide. And, you know, I certainly understood that point of view, but my role and what I actually wanted to do there was to try to persuade them that Trump would be worse. And that, unfortunately, is often the position we find ourselves in on a lot of issues. It's like the lesser of two evils. And I just, you know, I could not wrap around my... I know there were people who said, actually, this will be better. We'll go down this road. Trump will blow everything up. We'll build a new left.
Accelerationism.
And someday we'll all be living in a utopia, but we first have to go through this. I just never see that route. I just don't see it. Does not appear to me. I feel like you don't go backwards to get forward, really. She has this slingshot analogy that she brings up every time she speaks in public, which is that, you know, like, yeah, the force pulling you back can also propel you forward. What do you think, Rob?
It's funny because we were talking before we turned the mics on, I think, about how socialism really and communism needed the Industrial Revolution and the bourgeois revolutions to sort of be able to build up industrial capacity to feed and clothe and house enough people to then be able to share in the bounty of the collective. And one of the reasons that the Soviet Union failed is because they didn't do that. So there is like some idea that like there has to be a stage in between, and I don't think it has to be worse. Like, I'm not an accelerationist, actually. I think it would be nice to have had, like, Bernie. Would have been a nice compromise. Like, he's a regular Democrat. He votes with the Democrats. 10 years later, you know, a Markel Democrat is now Bernie bro. So, yeah, I think it would. I don't think it has to get worse for it to get better. However, like, on the Gaza thing, not only should you not be put in that position, there's no option. And actually, if I was put in that position, how would you say it's... I mean, Trump actually at least stopped people from getting slaughtered every day. They're only killing maybe 50. Now they're in Jenin refugee camp, bulldozing refugees in the West Bank. But, you know, the violence has actually gotten slightly less. So, actually, Biden was worse.
Well, in the sense that, you know, BB sees Trump as basically being on his side. And so you give him a little something because you know you're going to get more of what you want down the road. I think that's the dynamic that's at play there.
I mean, to be perfectly honest, and I've said this before about just sort of being a student of history, I've had to think about it a little more because people are starting to critique my corporate Mandela because they don't fucking understand what I'm trying to do. But we're going to have a lesson, actually, next week. I have a full lesson. I have a big poster we're going to bring out. I'm going to teach everybody.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you.
But I think that, you know, the danger of having to go through the bad thing to get to the good thing is that, of course, the bad thing never leaves. And like Franco in Spain, right? I mean, how long? People lived their whole lives under him.
Was that like 40 years?
Yeah.
Was the 39 to he was the 80s?
Yeah.
And same thing in Portugal, right?
Yeah, but you had this is why it's so important to try to convince people to make it to make it a starker difference. This is what I was going to say. For so long, and we had the conversation in here years ago. talking about Mandela and Sankara and all of these revolutionaries. Like, we couldn't even say apartheid. If you said Israel was an apartheid state, you'd go on some kind of fucking blacklist. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm not abiding by that. I never got canceled either for it. And again, because I knew the history, because I've been to South Africa, you know, I knew a little bit more, and I knew nobody was going to jam me up on this, but it wasn't even in the conversation that you could mention, oh, by the way, they've ethnically cleansed Palestine and put people in camps for the last 4 years. That seems weird. Like, it was, you couldn't even say
there's
that.
There's a lot of lesson learning going on. And also, as people like Biden move off the stage, it creates opportunities for policies that really weren't possible. Because let's face it, the main reason why the U.S. didn't change anything on Israel is just because Biden's been so locked in for his entire life. And expecting him to, like, change much at that age just didn't seem realistic.
No, I don't think he was going to change. I think the problem comes back to the fact that it's an institutional Democratic Party problem. Biden was handpicked to beat Bernie, knowing that this was part of his deal. But that's what, I mean, that's why I opened the whole conversation with her with this sort of lineage of history. Yeah, of course, we got ourselves in this situation. People are starting to recognize that. And if we don't start sort of letting people know in a genuine way that we're reflecting on the mistakes we made, this is why, you know, it seems easy to me, but maybe I'm crazy.
Well, I mean, there's a lot, like, as you said, you never got canceled, but a lot of people did get canceled for even just trying to protest against what was going on. And then a lot of those people doing the canceling have a ton of money. So it's like, you know, the Democrats have always been pretty cautious, I think that's fair to say. So, yeah, I mean, you know.
But who got canceled? Like the president of Penn or something get canceled? Or? Like
the word I would use for those is like political repression more so. And I think even in the cases, whether it's left or right, because we were talking a little bit about cancel culture, also between when the mics are off, which we don't need to get too far into. But I think my personal, this feels almost quaint now, because I feel like this is a very Trump era one cancel culture as a political topic. But my annoyance with that as just like a concept in and of itself is I think there was something new to be talked about in terms of the ability of like the Twitter mob or the social media mob, for like lack of a better word, in their ability to impose power. But I think the question has always been not about like cancel culture or not cancel culture or canceling or not canceling, but rather like who has the power to inflict actual punishments on people, and then what are the interests of those people? And I think in the case of the Israel-Palestine stuff, it's very clear that like the Congress, the NYPD, the heads of some of these universities had all the power because they were able to bring in and crush these protests. So I think repression, like political repression, is my personal frame for like if that stuff is, and that also fits into what we're talking about in terms of larger questions of power and who has power and who doesn't have power. Can I move this in a direction which I think might take us back to some of what we were talking about in the interview?
Yeah.
Because I've been thinking about this a lot in terms of Elon Musk's turn to the right. Because I think he was always probably like not great politically. But a lot of these Silicon Valley guys, they started out as like center left liberals or like centrist liberals, we'll say. Like people who were like, oh, yeah, I believe in gay rights, feminism.
On social stuff.
On social stuff. And like, you know, minimum wage or whatever, I guess that's fine. But like, just, you know, we don't want too many regulations or taxes, like normal centrist liberal stuff. And just looking at a bunch of the guys, both, I think, at a national level, like a very prominent level. But then also if you're looking at who are the people, you know, that have moved to the right in the last 10 years, let's say. One of the patterns that I've noticed is, I think cancel culture being kind of the framing here is basically someone who for whatever reason, felt called out or like alienated by liberal society, whether that be society as a whole, whether that be by family court being like a very common one for people like at a grassroots level, whether that be by their kid came out as trans and they were not approving of it, and so they were just kind of driven insane by that, or whether it's this scientist guy tried to accuse me of not knowing what I'm doing, so I called him a pedophile, even though he knew more than I did. And this is the Elon Musk, the first case where I think he started to
the divers.
He was going to save them, and the guy's like,
"That's actually
no.
not going to work. It'll kill everyone." He's like, "You're just a pedophile."
Yeah.
He's like, "Whoa! Take it easy, friend."
And this is something that I think about a lot because, as you may know, I am the second most influential person in Delaware based on the 2022 News Journal poll.
I'm sure you'll link to it as well.
Yeah, but you know, we talk about power and lack of power and like we can do this or we can't do that. And as I've, you know, grown into the role that I have now, at the same time that I've become an adult, you have to become very aware of like, oh, even if I don't really have relatively that much power compared to like, you know, an elected official or something, I do have power that I have to learn how to, what I have the ability to do, what I don't have the ability to do, and what I can influence and not influence. And I think what I've noticed with a lot of people who are making this hard right pivot is what they want is power without accountability. And I think you're seeing that with like Trump. You've seen that with Elon Musk. That's like the dream is that like I can do whatever I want and all these people that are making me feel bad about it, I can just tell them to go fuck off, or I can fire them, or I can take away all their funding. All these people are trying to make me feel bad or trying to give me some sort of consequences, whether that be regulation or social impositions or whatever it is. Screw them. I mean, it was like the banker who was like, oh, now that Trump's elected, we can silently say slurs again at work. Like, that's the driving impulse that it feels like behind a lot of the Elon Musk, Donald Trump stuff especially. And I don't really know how to deal with that because I think everybody has warring impulses where you have been the person in power who has had power over somebody and that person has annoyed you or not done what you wanted. And you're like, screw this. This person needs to get in line. They need to get themselves together. I can get myself together. I'm the one who has the power. I have this responsibility. But then we've also all been in that situation where we're on the other side of that equation, where we've been the one who's been taken advantage of or mistreated or something else by somebody in power. And I think a lot of us, if you're like a rich, wealthy white guy, you've had a lot more of that former experience than you've had of that latter experience. Whereas if you're like a poor immigrant woman who doesn't have rights and you're like, you've worked for wages your whole life, you probably have a lot of that former experience. But a lot of us in between, a lot of us aren't billionaire white guys. And most of us are not like immigrant domestic workers. And so there's a lot of people in between who are constantly warring that out. And it feels like right now we're very much in the era of that first impulse of like, screw that, I want my power, but I don't want to have to deal with like having to think about how that power is affecting other people.
Yes, especially in Silicon Valley. I think
big
Mark Zuckerberg, for example, felt like he had to make a lot of concessions to his employees on things like having feminine products in the men's restroom.
Yeah.
And that's like the first thing he pulled out, like the day Trump took office. I think there were, like the New York Times, there was this rebellion over Tom Cotton's Send in the Troops editorial.
Yep.
And, you know, the Times editors had to kind of like come and listen and get told how wrong they were, and they didn't like it.
Yeah.
And so when there was the opportunity to kind of like seize back.
Yeah. When you have that, I've heard a lot of people refer to this general push for the last few years as like the bosses' revolt, because it's obviously there's an economic component to it, but there's very much like a social component as well of like my woke employees are asking me to do these things and I don't want, and like I'm based, so I don't want to do that.
Bosses' revolt. Yeah, I hadn't heard that. I hadn't heard that sort of put in those terms, but it makes sense to me.
I think a lot of the fact that this has played out as a culture war has been even for like last however many decades now, is kind of relying on the fact that the machine kind of just runs itself at a certain point, Whereas Elon Musk has now gone in and started tearing the wires out of the walls and seeing what breaks and what doesn't break. That I do think, and with the tariffs too, to a certain extent, I know they're the Atlanta Fed, I think, predicted a negative 1.5% decrease in GDP or something for this upcoming quarter, like something insane. That was largely due to like responses from the tariffs. But I do wonder if things break enough, if we see that move back towards like economics being more central to how things are run. And that is why I was, you know, I think the left and maybe even myself get reputations for calling out when people say things we don't like, but not congratulating them when they say things we do like. And so I think in that spirit, I think it's worth, as we were saying, shouting out Sarah's messaging on this, which is, yeah, she's saying what Bernie's been saying. She's been saying what we've been saying for the last years. And like, as long as that plays itself out in policy, which I haven't seen any indication that she's going in like a totally different direction from what she's saying, I think that's just, she was appealing to us in her
yeah,
language.
I mean,
she said it metaphor sincerely. Is a good metaphor.
Yes. I mean, and she was sincere about Bernie. And then to back that up with, you know, basically the Four Freedoms and the New Deal, that's, you know, maybe she's pulling the wool over my eyes. I don't know, but I'm down with that. I'm down with that for sure.
Yeah, if people are willing to, like, and I think there's been a group of people, it's not everybody, but there's a sizable group of people within the Democratic Party that took the lessons from 2024. And I think you even saw this in 2020, the fact that she mentioned Build Back Better and the Inflation Reduction Act. There was a lot of good stuff in there. And like the FTC, the NLRB, a lot of people within the Democratic Party even then took the Bernie and Warren economic message and started to apply it. And I think that was, and the fact that the first 2 years of Biden were actually pretty decent before he.
Well, it was funny because she mentioned Build Back Better. So my general Rolodex is going to go like, okay, make a joke.
Yeah.
Like, think of a good joke to make about Biden. And as I thought about it, I'm like, actually, it was pretty good.
Yeah,
that part was actually pretty good. Yeah.
A lot of included very progressive economic policy.
If they could have got that child tax credit thing,
that would have been big.
You know what? That would have
another own goal again. Another just turn around and smash it to your own net.
Well, remember around that time I was writing a piece for the Delaware Call, calling for the U.S. Senate to be abolished.
Still agree.
Which I'm now going to retract. But
we're definitely ending on that joke, by the way. I love that.
Okay.
All right, Carl, thank you. And Andrew, thank you. This worked out very well. I had a good time too. So thanks for doing it.
Me too. Yes, thanks for having me.
Cool. And yeah, you get all of this stuff on a very professional podcast. You know what? I'll promote it later. For now, left is best.